You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
No, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tech Talk Radio. I'm your host, Andrew McComb. During the course of last week, I had the task of reconnecting to a mobile broadband service as a result of the theft of my broadband card the previous week. A task which, on the surface, should be relatively simple, painless, and quick, but in the wash-up of the week was one of the most arduous tasks I've ever undertaken. The process was simple: replace my Next G SIM and unsuspend the service, purchase a new mobile broadband card outright, and set up my laptop. Easy. Well, it should have been. It all started last Tuesday when I paid a visit to my local Telstra shop to get a new SIM card and reactivate my Next G account. I stood in a queue at the Camberwell branch for what seemed like an hour, but was more likely 20 minutes, waiting and watching while three staff members stood around a counter PC arguing over a product code. When I was finally acknowledged and served, the salesperson tried to upsell the Telstra Express card, valued at $450, of which he didn't have one. Gotta give it to him for trying. The approximate time I spent in store to replace my SIM card was around 45 minutes. Having a Telstra SIM in hand, I headed off to my local 3 shop to buy an Express NetConnect card, at a more realistic price of $199. The guy at 3 was most helpful, sympathetic towards my lost network card, and associated my new network card to my existing account. The time spent at 3 was around 15 minutes, no waiting, but most of it paperwork. At this point, the process was as I expected it. So back to work I went, new SIM and new mobile broadband card in hand. All that was left to do was to unlock the card and get back online. Next, I called through support to unlock the card, a process that I'd done before, which at that time took no more than 5 minutes. This is when things started to go downhill. The Mumbai telemarketer had no problem to perform the task I asked him. It was just a technological challenge to get the device unlocked and on air. To cut a very long story short, the card could not be found in the account, and as a result, he didn't have the IMEI number. We then proceeded to dispute the IMEI number. He said it should start with the numbers 5353, and I told him the 15-digit IMEI number printed on the mobile card and on the receipt. I think he found my MasterCard number instead. At this point in time, it was time to terminate the call and move on. Cutting a long story even shorter, I thought I'd subscribe to a new 3 broadband service and have the new card that I bought associated to that. That was bound to fix all the problems. I did this first thing Wednesday morning. Normally, a service comes alive within 15 minutes or so, and the 3 standard answer is 4 hours. After 4 hours, nothing. So back to Mumbai I went. This time, my focus was to get the card working on 3, the broadband card's home network. That's got to be foolproof, I thought. Not so. 3 support could see everything was in place, but the service wouldn't work. They tweaked things their end and assured me that all would be well in 4 hours. Fixed, I thought, and back to work I went. By 6 p.m. on Wednesday, the broadband card could find 3's network but couldn't connect. But if I put my 3 SIM from my telephone service in the card, it worked, so I knew it was a network-related issue. Back to Mumbai I went. This time, Mumbai sent me back to the 3 shop to get a new SIM card, as he thought the SIM I had was faulty. On the way to work at 9 a.m. I collected a SIM card and was told the standard line, give it 4 hours. 4 hours came and went, but still no go, so back to Mumbai again. This time, an incident report and job number was raised, and I was told that they'd look into it, with no time frame for a resolution. By 2 p.m. on Thursday, I started to get very annoyed. Later that day, I rang Mumbai again to express my disappointment in 3's service and inability to connect a mobile broadband service. This time, the service telemarketer started to try and convince me that the problem lay with my equipment, not with the network. I tried to convince him that if I put my phone's 3 SIM card into the broadband card, it worked and it was not my equipment. But this fell on deaf ears. Friday morning had arrived and it had now taken 3 days and counting to connect a broadband service which normally takes 15 minutes. Another call to 3's support had rendered the same result. So drastic measures were now required. I arrived at my local 3 shop, laptop and broadband card in hand, and so I befriended Nick and informed him of my sit-in. I was not going to leave the store until my laptop was online using 3's network. Nick's customer service was excellent. At no stage did he ever try and give up or use the 4-hour line. But the challenge at some stage seemed insurmountable. By 1 p.m. Friday, I was on the air, an hour and a half after arriving at the store. This time, it was poor Nick who had to spend all the time on the phone to support. 3 SIM cards and 3.5 days later, I was connected again. It's at this time that you have to ask yourself, is it worth it? Let's face it, we need to be online, but all up, I would have wasted 10 or 12 hours getting things working. With telecommunications, do you get what you pay for, or is this just the nature of the telecommunications beast? Maybe both. 3, lift your game. Now, back to unlocking the device. Wish me luck.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Adam answers the questions that can cause more problems in the household than any other. Does size matter? And is 50 inches too big? Virgin plucks broadband at home from retail shelves. LCD manufacturers admit to price fixing. Battery-powered credit supercard fights fraud. And 3 launches an affordable Facebook phone. First up, though, here's the latest happenings from the Tech Talk News Desk with Dr. Ron.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, global spam levels dropped by up to 75% after the disconnection of US web host Mercolo. ANZ bank ATMs come to a grinding halt. That Qantas Airbus plunge is still being investigated by the ATSB. Australia's proposed web filter will block 10,000 sites. And now Google can even help you beat the flu. Welcome to Tech Talk News. Global spam levels have dropped by as much as 75% following the shutdown of a US web host that provided the backbone for most of the world's spam. The Washington Post reported on Friday that the bust sent spammers scrambling, and although it occurred on Tuesday in the United States, spam volumes remained down towards the end of the week, according to internet security professionals. The California-based web host Mercolo was unplugged by its internet service providers, Global Crossing and Hurricane Electric, following a 4-month investigation by the Washington Post. US law enforcement authorities have yet to announce if any action is being taken against the company. Mr. Richard Boddington, a lecturer in economics, commerce and law at the Murdoch University, said the proliferation of spam was attributed to the ignorance of an extremely low yet lucrative number of internet users who responded to spam emails.
There's enough gullible humans around and you only need one in maybe 1,000 or maybe 10,000. And if you can use the leveraging of emailing, you can get to a very large audience and you'll find sufficient people to respond to your fake advert, entice them in. You know, there's an old saying that small fish taste sweet. If you can get lots of small fish with a limited risk, you can be bold, you can use your imagination to suck people into the net, I guess.
Mr. Tom Worthington, a senior lecturer at the Australian National University, spoke on government radio last week and offered some basic advice to consumers to further reduce the proliferation of spam.
Make sure your spam filter's working. Don't click on these products because if it sounds too good to be true, invariably it is. And the other thing is we need to make sure that the regulators in terms of business and the police forces are well-resourced to combat these systems.
Following the disconnection of American ISP Mercolo, service providers in Australia noticed a drop in spam traffic of between 50 and 75%. Many ISPs, however, expected to see spam levels return to previous levels in a matter of days, as owners of botnets found new ISPs and bandwidth providers. The ANZ Bank's automatic teller machine network came to a grinding halt on Friday last week. The bank confirmed that retailers and consumers using ANZ's nationwide FPOS and ATM network were unable to complete transactions after the network became unusable following a massive input of invalid data by a large merchant customer. The slowness caused timeouts for transactions, which in turn resulted in transactions not being processed. ANZ were apparently able to remedy the problem by restarting network switching hardware. An ANZ spokeswoman said they were investigating the incident to ensure that it didn't happen again. Australia's aviation safety watchdog, the Australian Transport Safety Bureau, is still considering the possibility that interference from a defence communications base was to blame for a sudden Qantas flight plunge in October, which injured 44 passengers and crew. A preliminary report released on Friday last week said there was a possibility that radio transmissions from the Harold E. Holt Naval Communications Station had interfered with the Airbus A330's onboard inertial reference system. While unlikely, the ATSB said the theory could not at this stage of the investigation be ruled out entirely. A similar incident in 2005 saw a Malaysian airline flight between Perth and Kuala Lumpur suddenly lose altitude. That incident was blamed on faulty accelerometers feeding erroneous data to flight control computers. A report in the Herald Sun last week revealed that Australia's proposed net filter could block up to 10,000 sites as part of a blacklist of unspecified, unwanted content. Communications Minister Senator the Honourable Stephen Conroy revealed more details of the Rudd government's proposed web filter last week and called for expressions of interest from internet service providers for a live trial of the technology. The trial will start before Christmas and is expected to last 6 weeks, relying on volunteer subscribers to test the new filter. The proposal has been met with fierce opposition from the IT industry. Electronic Frontiers Australia board member Colin Jacobs said his civil liberties group was concerned at what exactly would be deemed unwanted content. And a new Google application may be able to detect regional outbreaks of the flu virus up to 10 days before they're reported by the US Center for Disease Control and Prevention. In February, the CDC reported flu cases spiked in certain states, but Google says its data recorded a spike in searches for flu symptom queries 2 weeks before a report was actually released. Experts say that this observation has significant potential for disease prevention and that in theory, researchers could use Google's information stream to learn about other disease trends as well. I'm Dr. Ron, and that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
My wife got a new car stereo recently installed and there's a cable dangling down. She said, what's this for? She said, it's for your iPod, sweetheart. She said, what's an iPod?
I'm under considerable pressure at work to buy and use Final Cut Pro for our video editing.
Play and learn, and then when you want to learn the detail, there must be an easier way of doing this, then I look in the book.
ComSec introduced the iPod Index.
Well, the key fob things are another level of a challenge response authentication process.
Digital certificates as well.
Now, you've also got to be wary of credit card numbers that may be stored in your machine.
Oh, they haven't.
Oh, yeah. VoIP is illegal in China.
Adam said WOPTUS as well.
We're going to have lots of fun with this.
You know, Melbourne and Sydney. People in Melbourne like having a go at people in Sydney, and people in Sydney like having a go at people who live in Melbourne.
Dr. Ron's test tube aliens.
That's perfect for people at home who want to knock up something for the Christmas reel.
Wife acceptability factor.
WAF.
The WAF.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Yes, the wife, I can't even say it, Dr. Graham. The wife acceptability factor, WAF.
I heard about that.
It's a new acronym that's been added to the vocabulary.
Yes.
How are you? This is Andrew McComb. Sitting across the front of me here is Dr. Graham, because none of the others have managed to front this evening. They'll have other options.
Well, I was missing last week.
So
I think they've decided that I can take the load this week,
I think that was the plan, actually. Mm. I just rang Dr. Graham and he said... I just rang Dr. Ron and his beloved answered the phone and said, oh, he's a bit tied up.
I see. He's found something better to do.
I should read the emails more often. How's your week? You ended up sleeping at a customer's place the other night, hence the reason why you
almost,
went on the radio last week.
Had a big cutover. It was
customer moving to new Windows servers and Exchange
the new one,
and all
2008?
That stuff. No, actually, it'll probably be the last one we do. That's Small Business Server 2003.
Okay. And you moved them across?
Moved them across.
And it didn't quite
all their emails.
Happen the way you anticipated?
Well, I thought I had a really good plan to get their emails imported. And it worked in the test environment, but when it came to import a real user's email, it all fell in a hole.
big hole? Deep hole?
Didn't impress me at all.
big round hole?
Yeah.
Deep? Was it deep?
Was very deep.
dear, that explains it.
It took me a while to crawl my way out of it, hence the lack of sleep and the issues on Monday. But there you go. I spent all day on site on Monday, did about 11 hours on site. So
oh, well done, that man. Someone has to keep the economy going.
Got them all back on air and all their emails working and everything right.
Very good. You've done well. We've got an interesting show this evening. We're going to be having a chat to some guys in Western Australia later this evening about Viridian home loans. I mean,
no,
Microsoft Viridian. what do you call it? Yes.
Hyper-V.
That's it.
Hyperventilate, isn't it? Now, this is, if I understand correctly, some sort of virtualizing technology. So you can run effectively more than one. You can use one computer as if it's more than one computer.
We'll ask Anthony or Alex the question when we get him on the line later on. But yes, according to the technical version of Wikipedia, Microsoft Hyper-V, codenamed Viridian, formerly known as Windows Server Virtualization, is a hypervisor-based virtualization system for 64-bit operating systems. And a beta version of the Hyper-V shipped in the first version of Windows 2008, and I think they've got the final one out in Windows Server 2008, which I got a copy of, the real, legit SBS 2008.
Oh, it
came out
exists,
with my Microsoft dealer thingy bob the other day.
So oh, okay.
I've got the DVDs now. It's going to be my Christmas project to build a new...
To build a test server and see what it's
an
all
SBS
like.
An SBS 2008 server or an enterprise server, whatever. Oh, right.
I'll have a chat with you after the show.
Oh, good.
I want to know how this all works.
Yeah, well, new frontiers. Anyway, yes. That's on tonight's show. Google's up to all sorts of tricks. Adam's going to tell us how big it needs to be for the living room. I think that's very important.
apparently size has become a bit of a dispute for Adam.
Size is an issue. It's becoming an issue. So we'll talk a bit about that. And in the meanwhile, if you'd like to talk to us, you can come along to our chat room, chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
Oh, chat room. I knew I hadn't opened something up.
Haven't you? Oh, well, there you go. Just log in now. There's a full board of eager listeners sitting there talking about Firefoxes and Safaris and all sorts of things. Come and ask us a question if you'd like to participate. So anyway, upwards and onwards with the show. I had a bit of a rant on the beginning, as you may have heard.
Last week?
Just now, in relation to my getting my mobile broadband
card. Oh, yes, you're three and...
How hard is it?
Well, it sounds like it's harder than I thought it should have been.
Oh, look...
Three used to have good customer service, didn't they?
Yes. Well, it's not the customer service, it's the technology, as I sort of alluded to.
It just gets away from them, does it? There's just too many new devices and... Not enough training.
Well, it could be that. It could be also the fact that, for whatever reason, maybe they were having their email migrated on the day or something like that that I chose to load up my new mobile broadband card. Just as you're probably aware of, some lovely person decided to liberate mine, and I had to go and get a replacement one, didn't I?
Yeah.
Now, I walked into a Telstra shop and fell over backwards, so then I walked out of the Telstra shop and went down to the local 3 shop to replace with the original card.
Yeah.
And that was good. It was good. It was a nice... And I'd like to send a cheerio to Nick from our local shop down the road. He said he'd probably tune in tonight and have a bit of a listen. He was good. He was a trooper. Hung in there all the way from, hi, I'm not leaving here till I get my broadband going, until... Thank you for coming.
Until your broadband was going.
Until it was going, yeah.
Well, that's impressive.
Do you know I went through...
Definite points for that.
Three SIM cards I went through before we got it going.
Really?
Three.
So it was a problem with the SIM card or the programming of the card? Or
No, it was a problem with their network and they wouldn't admit to it.
Let's try the SIM card because we don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I got to the point where I said, let's cancel the account, start again, see what happens. And Nick was going, yeah, hang on, let's try and get this one going first. Mm. So anyway, I've got to try and get it unlocked like my last one was unlocked so I can have my choice of providers as I transverse this beautiful country of ours. So anyway, that was my dilemma for the week. So if I'm looking a bit like I've been through the ringer, it's because I spent 18 hours talking with the man over in Calcutta, wherever he is. Anyway, let's talk about other things. Mr. Senator Stephen Conroy.
Oh, yes, my
fault. The internet filter and all that sort of stuff. It's probably a good spot to start with this evening. Senator Conroy has continued to expand the reach of his proposed mandatory net filter, saying that he will block up to 10,000 new sites that contain unwanted material. And, of course, there's some ISPs that are actually starting to sign up to his plan, which is a bit of a concern. One of them is the one which I use, which is iiNet. I just think that it's a little bit, you look at what Internode have done.
Have you rung iiNet and told them that you don't approve of this?
No, I should. I should record it too and see what they say. I'll play it back on the radio next week. Actually, I'll do that.
You can bet their customer service records everything you say.
Oh, yes. Yes. And that's never been played back at me in vengeance, though. Not that I'd do that on the radio. They're going to start looking at, domain names and things like that. I don't know whether they're going to go down the IP factor, because that's going to take out half the world's internet on virtual servers. And it's going to be very interesting to see how slow it actually gets.
Yeah, well, the speed issue is one thing, and of course no one wants their internet to be potentially slowed down, but there's a bigger issue. There's a censorship issue, and there's an issue of how much mothering do we really need?
Well, there was an election here in, I can't remember if it was federal or a state election, but we were talking about the nanny state kicking in from time to time.
And this is a bit of a problem. I mean, I don't need my internet filtered. I don't need objectionable material. I don't look at illegal material, and I don't need objectionable material filtered. There's my internet connection in my house, serves the people that live there. There's no one lives there that's below the age of about 35.
Can I suggest that Google actually filters the internet quite well? Oh, I must turn that down. Sorry about that. Go away, whoever that was. Google actually filters the internet quite well in respect to the fact that it won't not let you go to a site. It will give you a warning.
It'll give you a warning. Yeah, that's right.
If you're going to a site which has had malicious software put on it and they've detected it when they've been indexing the website.
Or you can make the choice with Google when you set up the settings, whether you want to provide a filtered version of the results or whether you want to get the unfiltered version of the results. They call it safe search.
They do.
Hmm.
But even when you go to a site and it's had phishing, whether the owner of that site knows or not, and it's had phishing software put on it to capture something.
Yeah, that's right.
Google will come up and go, hey, warning, and you get this little red man with a little stop
ball
or something pops up on your screen and says, we're not going to stop you from going here, but we really recommend that you don't.
Hmm. And that's a sensible approach to it.
I would have thought that's all that's needed, really. Not unless they want to get a little man with hand over the jammies or something, I don't know, to stop those sort of sites. But Google doesn't index them anyway, from my understanding.
No.
They have a fairly interesting algorithm, for want of a better term. I think we've spoken to the guys. I actually remember speaking to Microsoft Search about it. And they were saying that they have three tests for flesh tones and for facial references and for body shapes and things that.
Okay.
When they're looking at images, and then they can then categorize and sort of get their search happening according to that.
But and again, with the Google image search, you can choose to turn that filtering on or you can choose to turn it off.
Mm.
So, and again, they call that their safe search feature. But to have the government decide, oh, well, you're not allowed to look at certain sites that we think are just a little bit nasty, not illegal, just a little bit nasty, then, I think that might be... It's the thin end of the wedge, and as you've already said, it's expanding. We're going to cover more sites. We're going to block more material. Every pressure group, every, unrepresentative, voice of a vocal minority is going to have another group of sites banned for their own particular reasons. So, and that's the danger, that if we start this process, that's where it'll end.
There's iiNet's the only organisation that I know that's sort of jumping on the bandwagon at the moment. There may be more. I don't think Simon Hackett from Internode will be doing it. He seems to be dead set against it, and grabs and stuff I've read from him of recent times.
Hmm.
But the bottom line of it is that Senator Conroy explained to Parliament that 10,000 banned websites would expand on the Australian Communications and Media Authority's current blacklist of 1,300. But I don't know who's going to sit there and go through and say yes, no, not having that one.
Well, that's the big question.
No,
who
not
makes
the next
that
one?
Decision? If the ACMA have looked at the issue and have found you know, what do you say, 1,300 websites that are, and the way they'll look at it is they'll say they're refused classification.
Old RCs.
Yes, they've got material on it that is beyond what can be classified, and if you can't classify it, you can't see it. But if he's blocking 10 times that number of sites, then, you know, that's going a lot further than just blocking the refused classification.
Indeed it is. Anyway, we'll watch this space. They've got a, I think when they're going to turn on, soon, they're going to have a bash at it.
Are they?
I thought they'd done their trials already, but maybe I'm...
Well, they'd done some trials of the technologies they were going to use, and that information's publicly available if you Google for it. You can find those trials.
All right. So, yes, protect your internet at all costs, I guess. Liquid crystal display manufacturers, otherwise known as LCD panels.
Yes.
The people who make those are admitting to price fixing, just as well they're not in a cardboard, otherwise they'd be in for all sorts of strife in this country.
That's right.
Three of the world's biggest LCD manufacturers have admitted taking part in huge price fixing conspiracy to drive up the price of their products. LG, Sharp, and, correct me if I'm wrong, right here, Changhua Picture Tubes. I don't know how they make LCD screens, but nonetheless, I thought about that when I read this originally, have all admitted their guilt after investigations by the US Department of Justice. The companies artificially fixed the price of TFTs, LCD panels, from September 2001 to June 2006. No wonder they were high in the beginning.
That's right.
But then again, plasma was fairly high in the early days too.
Well, any new technology is, but I think the point is that they've kept it high artificially after it should have started to drop.
Sounds like petrol companies too. Oh, we could go on, couldn't we?
Oh, petrol companies would never do that, would
no,
they?
No, absolutely not. The companies were fined, or are being fined, $585 million between them.
LG's, I wonder how much they made.
LG's paying just around 400 mil of that. So
mm-hmm.
It is a good question. I wonder if the fines are based on the profiteering that they made from price collusion.
Yeah, whether it's still worth it for them.
Oh, well, there's new technologies coming out. Sony have released the 11-inch OLED prototype has been out. That was relaunched back in January, I think, at CeBIT the CES show, should I say, in the United States. That's a pretty interesting little telly that's coming out. And
well,
of course,
there's been a bit of promotional stuff about for this new technology for a little while now, and it's been the next big thing for quite a while. But definitely promising. Shouldn't have anywhere near the amount of wasted heat and wasted energy of some of the current technologies, in that it emits light. It doesn't block light like the current technology does. So with an LCD screen, you've got a big bright white light behind it.
It's reflective, isn't it?
And where you want black, you've got to block that light from coming through. So that light then hits the black, gets absorbed, gets hot, and it's all wasted because all you get on the screen is black. But
that's very true, really. And you think about the old plasma technology. That was a gas which was electrified.
That's right.
Electronic charges went through it and it glowed.
That's right.
And that was fairly hungry on the jungle juice.
Definitely. So
we all need to have a responsible footprint on the planet now, so we're told.
That's
and
right.
I agree with that.
Yeah. And, the LED... technology in terms of light. I mean, we've used them as little indicator lights on devices, and they run cold and they're very efficient. All the energy that they use goes into producing the light. It doesn't produce wasted energy as heat like a light globe does. So, these are like the little green lights that you have on the front of your devices or whatever.
Yeah.
But they're starting to become, you can get LED lighting for real spaces now.
And that's only in the last few years coming to its
that's
own,
right.
hasn't it?
And we've all seen the new traffic lights, which are LED-based.
You can't miss them. They'll blind you at 7
they
o'clock.
They will.
At 6 in the morning, it's like, you have to put the sunnies
on.
And
that green colour. Oh. I've never seen anything so green in my entire life as the green LED traffic lights. But, very efficient and saves a lot of power. And
they should have a night setting on them, shouldn't they?
They should.
It'd really, you knock out half the LEDs in the green light and everyone will be able to see when the light goes.
Well, no, you don't knock half of them out. You just run less current through them, and then they last so much longer.
Do they? How long do they last? Do you know?
Well, I don't know, but I know from experience with my electronics background that if you run an LED at its full rated output, it doesn't last nearly as long. If you run it at half its rated output, it lasts almost almost literally forever. It just doesn't run out.
There you go. More reasons to use OLED and turn the contrast down a bit.
Yep. So it should be a good technology to watch. I can't wait.
How's your spam lately? Have you had much spam in your inbox?
Yeah, bucket loads.
But have you noticed it since Macolo shut down? No relation?
I haven't looked at the figures. I've got a lot of good spam filtering in place, which the last time I did look at figures was stopping a lot of spam. But
I have too. Have you looked in your junk mail box? You go, oh my goodness, when did all they come in?
To be honest, no. I've given up looking in my junk mail box. My spam filtering never gets a false positive, so... I haven't looked in there for quite a while, but you think in the last little while there should be a bit less in there.
I don't know. Dr. Ron reported on the news this evening that Macolo is an ISP, or should I say is a web hosting company that an ISP's decided to cut off during the course of the week.
Oh, yeah.
And as a result, the amount of spam just plummeted. Various security sources estimated that it fell by 40 and 75% shortly after the company's servers were disconnected.
Fantastic.
Bring it on.
Yeah.
More of that.
Yep.
So, it'd be interesting to see. Spam's not going to go away. We just have to live with it now these days and filter it the best we can.
To some degree, but you've got to do the best you can to shut these guys down. And perhaps if the other thing we can do is just to get the word out, don't click on things in spam. You know, if you've got a message from a company that you're not expecting to get a message from, that you haven't got a relationship with, and it's offering you something, don't click on it. Don't buy from them. Even if they're selling something you want, don't buy your software from them. Don't buy your drugs from them. Don't buy your whatever it is.
Who in their right mind to buy prescription drugs off the internet?
People do.
Why, because they're too embarrassed to go to the local or something like that?
I don't know why they do it. But, yeah, people...
You'd rather buy a trusted brand name when you're putting chemicals into your body.
You can tell that they do by the fact that the spam still exists. If no one ever clicked on it and no one went and bought the stuff, then the spam wouldn't exist. You know, the only reason they're doing it is because they are making money out of it. So it's, in a way, it's our own fault for being gullible and clicking on the things.
The spam also originates by... nasty people, and I don't mean that in respect to people that are just trying to take your money. They're organised crime syndicates and things like that. And I think as we had Bruce Matthews from the Australian Communications and Media Authority on the show, I think last year, he was talking about all that as well. And a majority of it comes out of America and China.
Yeah, well, the control of it, you know, obviously comes from the places where there's, a demand for this sort of money that... needs to be raised quickly. If a drug dealer in America wants to raise enough money to import some drugs from overseas, this is one of the ways he's going to do it.
Also, a survey, which I think Dr. Ron also reported on, found that the response rate to spam emails asking for credit card details was 0.00001%. It would result in a revenue level of $2,731.88 for the email used. So there you go. They still obviously, you just, that yeah. one in whatever, what, 12 million or whatever he said. That's what it is. So
that's right. Say, and that's enough for them to get their money back because it costs so little to send each individual message and they send millions of them.
What do you think about voice and
I like my
video
voice.
On these, you know, chat circuits and stuff like that these days? Used to be the realms of the keyboard. Now we're starting to see voice and video kick in.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Google is big on this at the moment, too, because they just got to keep on rolling stuff out. Google launches a voice and video chat. Did you hear about this?
No, sounds like old news.
Old news? Okay, sorry.
Sorry.
Search engine Google has launched a Gmail voice and video chat, making it possible for people around the world to chat in high-quality video within Gmail for free.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So there must be a new button in Gmail, because I must admit I pop in and pick up my Gmail stuff. I don't actually log into their servers.
Okay.
But you can now respond via pictures.
Yes, I've got my Gmail configured so that I can use IMAP to collect my Gmail, so it just appears in my other mail client.
Yeah, that's what I do as well. Yeah.
It's really, really very nice.
Have you checked your Gmail spam filter spam box lately? Oh, that works over time too.
I never the only emails I get in my Gmail, by the way, are the ones from you. I never see anything else in there. I never see a spam message.
Don't I send a Gmail, do I? Oh, there you go.
Oh, for the rundown.
Oh, okay, that one. Yes, subscribe that way. Yeah,
yes,
okay.
Because I subscribe to that with my Gmail address, yeah.
Okay. Well, with a webcam and a small web browser plugin, you can start video chatting on Gmail and Google Apps. There's no need to switch to another application or sign up for another account. And if you don't have a webcam, you can just chat with your voice. Plug a microphone in. Off you go. Gmail voice and video chat is being rolled out globally in 50 languages, supporting Gmail from English to Oriya. Is that a language? O-R-I-Y-A. If you can tell me how to pronounce that. Yes, and it's also on PCs and Macs. So you can do it on any platform, cross-platform.
Very good.
Google Apps customers get the service at no extra charge and can video chat with any other Gmail user or app users through the Gmail or through the Google network. So it'd be interesting to see what happens. But it's just evolution, isn't it? We're all going to look at this laptop here. Everything's got a webcam in it these days. It's embarrassing.
And it's adding a feature to Gmail. A lot of people spend a lot of time in Gmail. I'm not one of them, but a lot of people do. I when I'm doing chat type things, I'm using MSN Messenger, and I've had voice messaging in that for a long while. And it works really well. I've talked to people overseas in real time for extended periods on that for free, which is really nice.
It'll just chew up bandwidth, and, which we don't have fairly shortly, I suspect, all this video chat.
Well, that's one issue. Yeah, it will use a little bit of bandwidth. It won't use a huge amount if you've got a halfway decent plan.
It's not very popular on the chat. Stryker was saying that he hates voice and video chat. I must admit, unless you're ready for it, it's like even with Skype, you don't hit the video button unless you absolutely have to. And I think that's also a reason why... video conferencing on mobile telephones, you know, the video side of stuff. I think it's never taken off.
You don't really...
drunken at a party and you've done some great amazing feat which you have to show your friends. If showing visually, it's the only reason why it needs to do it. So.
Yeah, although I must admit when I'm chatting to people overseas, it's nice to be able to see their face and that sort of stuff. But yeah, you've got to pick your moment and pick when it's appropriate. Yeah.
Absolutely. And also Google have added voice search to the iPhone. So if you've got an iPhone, see, if JD was here tonight, he'd be right onto this, but he sent his apologies later this afternoon too. Google has allegedly released its latest contribution to the iPhone App Store for approval, voice-based Google searching. Now, instead of typing in, where is my nearest pizza restaurant, and receiving a multitude of personal ad sites, that's a problem, I don't have an eye, I don't have that problem, you can simply speak out loud to your phone while people look at you like a crazed person. Imagine doing that on the train in peak hour on the way home.
Yeah, it'd start searching for what the people sitting in the seat behind you were talking about.
Oh, look, the mind just boggles, doesn't it?
I had that trouble talking about this voice recognition stuff. I had this trouble a while back. You know how when you ring Telstra customer service, it asks you to say things, you know, tell us what your thing's about, what your inquiry is about, and you say mobiles or my home phone or disconnections or something, and you have to speak it. You have to speak it out loud. Well, I was trying to get onto this while I was standing, I was walking down the street in the city, and
I've got this mental picture in my mind now of you blaspheming in a telephone.
Well, I didn't get the chance. As soon as the prompt started, it would hear a word that someone nearby me said, and it would skip the prompt and go on and try and do what they were talking about.
The mind boggles, really.
It was really frustrating because it wouldn't even complete asking any of its questions because as soon as it started, it
couldn't even get
a
consultant
word
out or whatever the quick bypass is for Telstra IVR. No,
no. As soon as every time it went into that mode of listening, and it listens while it talks, so you can barge in. It would, yeah. You couldn't even get to what it was asking.
So, did you hang up on Telstra, or did Telstra hang up on you?
I hung up on them, and
say anything bad when you've got hold music and Telstra ears in your ear.
I heard that. Yeah,
that's another story. Listen to last week's podcast. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
If you listen to Tech Talk Radio live, you've probably wondered why you can't chat with the panellists in real time. Surely such technology exists. Well, now it does. chat.techtalkradio.com.au. By popular demand, you can now chat real time with panellists and other Tech Talk enthusiasts. All you need is a web browser, an internet connection, and a comfy chair. Monday nights at 8 p.m, go to chat.techtalkradio.com.au.
Graham, when you go down to the white goods shop and you're looking at those big televisions on the wall, is bigger good? Are you going to buy the biggest one you possibly can? Is it going to be proportional to your budget?
It's probably going to be proportional to my budget, but also proportional to the amount of room I've got. So,
well, that's a very good point you make there, and Adam's about to make the same point. In when you do go down and buy your big set to hang on the wall, there's optimum viewing distances, which makes good sense, really, doesn't it?
So, yes.
And then, of course, there's budget considerations as well. If you buy yourself a known brand name and spend good dollars on it, chances are it's going to be what you're expecting, what you want. But maybe they're not so good brand names. Maybe the replicas, the made in Chinas and things like that. I think everything's
made
in China.
Well, I was reading about this, and the quality of the LCD panel. You can get funny little distortions in your LCD panels if you buy the cheap panels.
Yes, and also the delay, the audio delay between, it gives you lip sync errors and things like that.
Oh,
and some
I
of
really
the cheaper...
hate that when the audio and the picture are not in sync. Oh, that drives me absolutely batty.
It's one of the bugbears, I think, of the industry, especially with the advent of digital signals around the place, because everything gets delayed a little bit here and a little bit there.
Surely it's easy enough to measure how much is the delay for the picture and to make the sound delay exactly the same. It's all digital anyway. Digital delay is
you would think so.
Is not rocket surgery.
No. But in the world of television, analog television, and we still have, if you go to a lot of TV stations, they still have analog things because they're not made of squillions like they used to be. There's audio dilemmas between what you see and what you hear, and anyway, it's a long story. Well, not for tonight's show. Maybe another show. But Adam Turner, our regular correspondent, our view from the couch man from the Age of Sydney Morning Herald,
has asking a very important question.
A view from the couch this evening and asked the question. And you'll hear the WAF factor being involved here, the wife acceptability factor. I think this is a very key acronym that needs to be brought into day to day. You know, usage, because it is. If you're going to buy something for whatever reason, I bought a Harmony remote control the other day. My wife wouldn't even know what that was, let alone an iPod.
But speak to yourself. I don't have any problems with a wife acceptability factor.
No, you saw the light, my friend. Hey, anyway, here's Adam's view from the couch tonight, all about large screens and which one should you get and why and how and all that.
We all dream of owning a huge television. But bigger doesn't always mean better. It depends on both the size of your lounge room and the size of your budget. Video files will tell you that the optimal viewing distance for full HD 1080p content is around 1.5 times the size of the screen, and screen sizes are measured diagonally. Any closer than this and you can see the individual pixels in the image. Any further away and you start to lose the fine details. For a standard definition picture, such as a DVD, you can move back to around 4 times the screen size without losing too much detail. A quick bit of maths will tell you that at 1.5 times, the optimal viewing distance for 1080p on a massive 50-inch television is around 2 metres. For your average punter, that's just crazy. Can you imagine the tongue-lashing your mother would give you if she caught you sitting that close to the idiot box? You might see every fine detail in the image, but for most people, it's just not comfortable or practical. As far as I'm concerned, for the average viewer, 2 times the screen size is about as close as you'd ever want to sit to the television. This means about 2.5 meters for a 50-inch television, which I found is a sweet spot if you really want to immerse yourself in a high-definition movie. For general viewing, you'd want to push your couch back to the 4 or 5 meter mark, so you don't notice all the little imperfections in the picture. So, should you march out and buy a 50-inch giant if your lounge room is at least 2.5 meters wide, maybe 3 meters once you're left for the couch? Not necessarily. It's time to think about aesthetics, particularly if you're concerned about your WAF. The wife acceptance factor. It's a somewhat sexist term, but it refers to a very real phenomenon. These televisions are huge behemoths that would absolutely dominate a room 3 meters wide. This might not bother you if you're setting up a dedicated home theater room, but it might if you're dropping this television into a multi-purpose living area which you share with your significant other. Squeezing a big ugly brute of a television into their elegant lounge room is likely to be a major point of conflict. The next issue to consider is your budget, as bigger definitely isn't better if you're buying an El Cheapo television. Big screens are great for showing off high def content, but they also magnify any imperfections in the image. This is when you rely on great video processing to give you the best possible picture. It's the secret sauce when it comes to televisions. In other words, it's not the size of your pixels that counts, it's what you do with them. This is where high-end televisions such as Sony Bravias and Pioneer Curo Plasmas are worth the money. They offer a great picture for high definition and non-high definition content, great contrast levels, they handle motion really well. Take a good look at the television wall at your local store and you can see the difference between the high-end televisions and the $9.99 specials. The bigger the screen, the more important it is to pay for a good brand. If you can't afford the top shelf gear, seriously consider dropping down a screen size. If your budget doesn't stretch to a 50-inch giant from one of the good brands, you'll get much more viewing pleasure from a smaller 42-inch set than from an El Cheapo 52-inch piece of junk.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
I think he's nailed it there. A 52-inch piece of junk. Don't buy one. Go and spend your money. Buy smaller and better quality. It really is. Good tip.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
You got anything digital at your place, Graham?
Anything digital?
As in television-wise?
Digital television? Yeah, yeah. I have a digital receiver and PVR.
Yeah?
Yep.
You happy with it?
No.
Oh, why not?
It's an absolute disaster area.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm very happy with mine.
Are you?
Why, what's wrong with yours?
I didn't spend enough money on it. I bought it cheapy.
Well, there you go. Maybe that's the lesson to be learned here in a lot of respects.
Yeah, the firmware in it, the programming in it is just nonsense. It doesn't work correctly.
Ah. But what about the picture quality you get?
You program it. Oh, picture quality is fine when it works.
Ah. Well, that's just it. Firmware.
But, yeah, when you program it to record a show weekly, it just randomly records it on any day of the week instead of the one you want. Well, as well as the one you want, usually. So your hard disk fills up with programs that are not recorded on the day you want.
Maybe it's working perfectly correctly. It's just logging onto the electronic program guide and it's just moving around the program schedule, as the networks tend to do.
No, it's it's definitely playing up. And there's, they've brought out three or four since firmware updates for it since I bought it. And each one of them says it fixes this problem and each one of them doesn't fix this problem. So, good on you, Wintel. Get it right.
One of those. Yeah, Chinese import, yes. I think, if I recall. That particular brand.
Yeah.
The brand I've got is terrific. It's got a USB port on the front of it, and I can plug a memory stick in, and I can record direct to my memory stick.
Yep.
And it doesn't have any problems getting the right channel at the right time.
Oh, that's good.
It's just a matter of getting the right program on the right channel at the right time.
Yours is a bit of a more expensive brand name. It's one of the known brand names, I'm betting.
I don't know. It's a Strongbox.
It's a Strong. Oh, the Strong. Yeah, well, they're the good ones, aren't they?
Well, I've only ever had them, and they've worked flawlessly for me, so they've been terrific.
Yeah, they're the ones that the fancy installers always install if you're getting something done set up really nicely in your home. So, yeah.
Really? I didn't know that. Is that what they ring around nowadays?
Well, a couple of places where I've been to set up fancy computer equipment, they've also got fancy audio-visual equipment, and yeah, it always seems to be that those sorts of people use the Strong receivers and the Strong PVRs.
Well, I'm looking forward to plugging that into my... I'm getting a new Bravia for Christmas, my Christmas present to myself. 200 hertz television set, which would be just lovely.
Yeah, that's the Sony, isn't it? That's the really nice one. Yeah.
Let me tell you, the Australian dollar is not working in my favour at the moment. Down to 64 cents, I think, today as we came on air.
Oh, it's been up and down a little bit, so yeah, might bounce back a little bit.
Well,
bit of luck, fingers crossed.
Petrol's coming down. That's an ominous sign, isn't it? Well, who knows? Who knows? Hey, listen, we'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to traverse the planet. We're going to go to the other side of the country and have a chat to some guys in Perth. Alex and Anthony, hopefully we'll get them online in a second. We're going to be talking about the Hyper-V technology. I always thought hyperventilate, but it's not really.
No.
Anyway, stay with us. We'll be back with that after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school. How can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus had, again, had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPod.
Betty's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking of the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on E-Pray, and you get a whole service. Just on.
How does it go?
It goes...
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb, sitting across the panel from me this evening. You've got that side of the panel all to yourself there, Dr. Graham.
Yep, lots of room to spread out all my bits of paper.
Absolutely.
And my PC and my mouse.
Now, you put computers together, and as you were saying before, you put in a server 2003
yep.
small business variety the other day for a client. Have you come across any of the new Hyper-V stuff that's... Well, actually, Small Business Server got shipped the other day, as we alluded
to earlier
on the
show.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to playing with
that. It's got Hyper-V technology in it.
Oh, yeah.
It's time to find out a little bit about it, I think.
Definitely, yep.
See what the deal is. Anyway, joining us from your ASP, from the other side of the country at the moment, I think we're going to be talking to Alex. Good evening, Alex. Good evening, gentlemen. There's two of you there at the moment, I know. How are you?
We're very well indeed, thank you. Together with me is actually Anthony Scuteri, who's one of our head engineers.
Very good. Well, many thanks for joining us. If you just grab a little closer to the phone, you're a bit soft there. Maybe it's just the tyranny of distance that we've got. But tell us a little bit about your ASP. And as we alluded to on the phone prior, it's not Active Service Pages.
No, it isn't indeed. We commenced operating back in 2000, actually, as a natural evolution from two parent companies, one of which was an internet service provider and the other was a Microsoft licensing company. So at the time, application hosting was being touted around, and the buzzword at the time was ASP, Application Service Provider. Of course, since then, that's been renamed to Software as a Service, or now Cloud Computing is the other buzzword that they're throwing around, but essentially it's the same thing.
Yeah, cloud computing being the word of the moment, where I think everyone's getting in on that act at the moment. So what it was, a mix of hosting, really, and technologies. Is that how it ended up, Alex?
That's how it ended up. I mean, back when we started, the key products that we were looking at hosting was things like Exchange Server and Commerce Server, so the more complicated website side of things. And that is still what we do to this day with some of the larger sites. And with that, we've moved into Hyper-V recently to get sites that need seasonal adjustments, such as the Electoral Commission site, which we'll probably be talking about this evening. Who had the recent election where we suddenly needed extra capacity fast, and that's where Hyper-V kicked in.
All right. So talk to me about the type of companies which are your clients. Obviously, you're talking about the Western Australian Electoral Commission being one of them. What other sort of organisations do you look after?
I guess the largest one would be McAfee for Asia Pacific. They've got a managed service as well, and we actually host it for the entire region. They approached us back in 2001, and we've been doing that since as well. We mainly operate through a reseller network, so we're one of these companies that host things that a fair few people use, but you've probably never heard of us simply because it's our resellers that you deal with, or even some of the more retail-y shops that sell McAfee managed services. Ultimately, it'll come through our data center here. Other large sites would include things such as West Australian newspapers.
Okay, so what actually do you do for them? What sort of service would they come to you to get? Obviously hosting, but obviously some form of collaborative websites?
Yes, websites is primarily what we do. Where we come into it over our competitors, I guess, is that we work fairly closely with the web developers, and there's a lot more project management that goes into change control. So when the coders come up with new technology and new ideas. We throw that through staging environments and load testing and stress testing. So ultimately, our customers who own the sites don't have heart failure when their website drops dead at critical moments.
Speaking of critical moments, I guess the Western Australian election being, or the W, what's it, the Western Australian Election Committee, or whoever it is,
Electoral Commission.
That's them, the Electoral Commission. They probably would have had heart failure when the recent election got brought forward a little bit, and you guys were looking after all of that. What happened? Can you tell us a bit about that?
I think that actually brought a bit of chaos to everyone. The Electoral Commission has actually been with us for a number of years. After some hosting failures in the past, we took that on, promised to make it work, and we did, and they've been a valued customer of ours ever since. About a half year ago, or a year ago now, they contacted us saying that they wanted to redevelop their site completely. They wanted to use an open language, so we suggested they look at PHP, which would be available to be hosted on Windows 2008 server when that was released, with IS7, which should be released to manufacture well and truly before the election. However, when they brought the election forward, that product had only barely been out. The Hyper-V, which we needed for scaling, was released to manufacture like a week before.
So yeah, it was in late July.
In late July, so it was pretty close. And on top of that, Anthony's wedding day was on that same particular day.
So you made the election and the wedding day?
We did indeed.
It
could have been very ugly. Go ahead, Graham.
No, I was just going to say, what exactly is this Hyper-V? What's it all about, and how does it help when you've got a large website with a significant changes going on like that?
Yeah, well, Hyper-V is a technology that actually started quite a while ago in the form of VMware. We've been doing virtualization for a while, and the whole premise is that you take a real server with a real bit of hardware and you build it to spec to be quite powerful, to have a lot of memory, so it can essentially then from there be used to host multiple virtual servers on that one server. So essentially you're utilizing the power in one big machine to be able to have small machines running higher-end products, and that's the way that the virtualization works. The best way to describe it is essentially to just take a large machine and break it into little boxes, and that gives you your smallest service. So essentially you're getting more bang for your buck. Hyper-V is actually a technology that evolved by Microsoft. They obviously were looking to compete in that space with VMware and whatnot, other virtualizations like Xen and whatnot. Started probably in the middle of the decade in 2004 as virtual server, and from there it's evolved into a more streamlined Hyper-V solution, which actually plugs into the hardware of a server more so than the older virtualization technology, which sat on top of the operating system.
So you get the Hyper-V, unlike I've used VMware before to do like development work on a server that had spare capacity, so I can do an install, try stuff out, then rebuild it using the VMware. But the Hyper-V one that you're talking about, that's built right into the Microsoft operating system. Is that part of the advantage of it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, what it does, it takes away any overhead that exists with the operating system. So, you know, you're essentially plugging right into that hardware, so you're directly accessing the CPU resource and the memory resource. And in fact, VMware does have a similar solution, ESX server, and that does the same thing. So your versions of VMware that you use typically are like the versions of the old virtual server that Microsoft released, where they sit on top of the operating system, but the newer Hyper-V technology is a lot more efficient in the way that it uses a system resource.
And how does that help you when you've got a major client either going through a major change or going through a big spike in activity like the Electoral Commission would have?
Yeah, well, I mean, in this case, it was an interesting one because, as Alex mentioned, whether the Electoral Commission came to us and kind of asked us, well, what do you guys suggest moving forward? At the time, that was looking at sort of March, April of this year, and we knew that I had hosted the site on a Linux platform before, and we knew that Linux Apache as a web server works quite well. It's quite a fast web server. We knew that it did the job last time, but
and it does scale fairly well as well when you need to have large collections of machines.
That's right. And what we were thinking with the Linux is that while it worked flawlessly and it did the job, our core business, as Alex mentioned, is more along the Microsoft line. So we obviously suggested that, you know, maybe you take a look at, and bearing in mind that Windows Server 2008 was around the corner, we said, look, let's just look at hosting it on Windows with THP. And that was a little bit of a big thing at the time, because really it hadn't been proven, hadn't been done. So the Electoral Commission took it on board, went with it, and a few months later they started the development cycle. At that stage we were looking at the election being called in February. So we thought we had quite a bit of time between the Electoral Commission and ourselves to get this site staged and developed and in the end hosted. That all changed, obviously, when Alan Carpenter called the snap election. So that was on the 7th of August, I believe, which was, as it turned out, exactly a month before my wedding. And you guys actually mentioned the WAF factor before. I'm calling this the pre-WAF factor, because there was no way that...
the fiancé acceptability factor, that's a new one, yep.
That's right. There was no way that she was going to allow me to do any sort of work on election day. So straight away right there. And just obviously as well, Alex and a few of the other guys from the company were all attending. So it was one of those things where we had to get it right. Otherwise, I was sure as hell going to pay. So
yep.
It was interesting to say the least. But just moving forward from that, the way that we evolved into Hyper-V as well was that we were always planning on deploying Windows Server 2008 in our network, but obviously given the short time frame and the request to host PHP on IS 7, we didn't actually have it in our production environment. We were still in the testing and staging, and obviously wasn't deployed.
You're talking about PHP, which is it's the scripting language that we're used to using on the Linux platform, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah. So it was a bit of a big deal, and Microsoft were, I'm not sure, with the release of Server 2008, it was one of the big factors of the new web server built into 2008 that you could actually host Linux,
yep.
Or PHP, sorry. And a lot of people had their doubts, Alex being one of them, I believe. I look across there, definitely had his doubts on whether it could be done properly. But in the end, it seemed to work well. And what we did...
And the virtualization fitted in?
Yeah, the virtualization fitted in from the point of view of that we didn't have the real hardware to host a Server 2008 machine at the time. And deploy a new set of web farms to have the IS7. So what that meant is, and it actually tied in quite nicely to the RTM release of Hyper-V, where we actually were able to then deploy Hyper-V server, and then essentially within a week of the election being called, we had the WA Electoral Commission site running in a two-server web farm based on two virtual servers that were running Windows Server 2008. 64-bit edition, mind you, as well, which is one of the other advantages of Hyper-V. It can run 64-bit OSs as well, which obviously give you better performance, better memory and whatnot. So, yeah, within a week, because of the Hyper-V technology, we deployed the servers and the Electoral Commission were happy. And that gave us about 3 weeks to make sure that the site could actually take the load on election day.
And part of the way you do that, I presume, is that having got a cluster of two going, you can then very quickly, just by copying files, clone those servers off to make many, many, many virtual servers. Is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the way that we designed the Hyper-V infrastructure was to make it highly available, which means essentially that we clustered the Hyper-V real servers, so the host machines, so that they were sitting on a SAN, a fiber SAN, which is a storage network. That storage network keeps a centrally kept copy of the virtual hard drives, and that way you can essentially share the resources even more across the two machines and make sure that if one machine went down, you'd still be able to fail over the virtual servers over to the working machine. So from that point of view, the reliability was great, but what that also meant is that we were able to then deploy in the week leading up to the election two more virtual servers into the mix to have a grand total of four virtual servers. And from that, we were pretty confident that it was going to be able to run the site on the wedding night or the election night.
That sounds pretty impressive, Anthony. And I guess you're probably the weakest link was potentially going to be the telephone company or the provider getting the bandwidth to your server so that you could serve out all the requests. How many? What was the demand like on the servers during the lead up and during the actual election?
Yeah, I mean, in the lead up, the demand was varying. The first phase that we actually hosted was the electoral roll, so people come and check all their enrolment details to ensure that they're correct. And, of course, people checking candidate information, those sorts of things. That wasn't too much, but during the peak of the counting, where everybody is just watching the site and pressing F5 every 30 seconds, we were running up to about 7,000 requests a minute.
Gee, I must admit, I plead guilty to that on election night. I'm quick on the F5 trigger. And did you have any palpitations? Was there any cause for concern at anywhere, or were you just...
Not really. I mean, the advantage of Hyper-V is, as Anthony mentioned, you're breaking up a large, powerful box into lots of little boxes. The election was on a weekend, so other sites that you host, which are typically very heavy on traffic Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, they're quiet on the weekend. So you can dynamically reallocate your resources to the web servers that were doing the PHP sites for the Electoral Commission on the night.
So how many other sites would have shared this new technology, or did the Electoral Commission have it all to themselves in this particular instance because it was so new?
They had their own dedicated guest machines, but the host machine was doing other work at the same time, but of course tuned down to allocate and prioritise resources to where they were most needed.
So what other applications would we use this new technology for? Obviously, an electoral commission type scenario is a perfect example, but what other scalable sort of industries would look to this technology?
It's a very cost-effective way of building redundancy into anything. That's great for us as hosters. The way we host things at your ASP is everything's on multiple servers. We do not host single boxes of anything. Simply because if a server does crash, and they do, hardware fails, we don't want to have hundreds of people on the phone bellowing at us, you know, how long till the server's back up, those sorts of things. So everything's hosted on two or more servers. And the nice thing with Hyper-V is you could actually have a single Hyper-V machine, because not every application likes to be load balanced on farms, and then you have multiple real servers or physical machines that could each host that particular guest. So should the host machine fail... other host machines will just basically carry right on, and they usually take over the machine system state and carry right on from where it was before. So it reduces downtime, which lets the engineers get on with keeping things running as opposed to handling phone calls to explain to people how much longer it's going to be down for.
I guess that's good for service-level arrangements and agreements and all those sort of things, as a lot of, I guess, highly stressed industries like to know that their website's going to be there 24/7. Tell me a little bit about the
level of criticality when it comes to customers. It's all urgent. There's no degrees thereof.
That's
I know all about that, yes.
So tell us a little bit about what you do for McAfee's, just briefly.
McAfee have a desktop antivirus product for corporate use, although we do sell that to small businesses and even individuals use it. It's a small agent. It installs on your machine, just like the traditional McAfee product. However, it reports back and receives all of its policy allocations off our data center. So for mobile users with their laptops, as they're out and about, instead of having to phone in back to their corporate networks via VPN, they can phone in through to us just with an internet connection, receive all their daily updates as you do with any antivirus product, get the new policy files, submit any reports on detections. The desktop firewall product is part of that suite, and that can be controlled remotely as well by the administrators, just via one central web console that we host here.
It certainly sounds like it's the way of the future, this virtualization of servers, not only for web hosting but for other applications too, as I guess this sort of technology can be rolled out. Alex and Anthony, it's been very interesting and informative discussion. I now understand a little bit more about Hyper-V. And with Microsoft just rolling out Small Business Server 2008, which I think has some form of Hyper-V technology built into it. What can it be used at a low-level environment, like an office web-serving environment or something like that?
Yeah, there's actually Microsoft actually released on top of the new Small Business Server, they actually released a standalone Hyper-V server, which is kind of like VMware's ESXi server as well, which is free. And what it essentially is, it's just a bare-bones server that essentially hosts Hyper-V. So that's free on the internet. You can download it going to the Microsoft site and whatnot. But that is going to allow small businesses to, again, consolidate their server hardware And it's a very, very easy install. You put in the DVD, it installs the server. Very basic, there's no sort of graphical user interface on it. So I guess from that point of view, it can be a little daunting to techs that aren't sort of used to the command line interface and whatnot. But that sort of technology and the fact that Microsoft has released that for free means that small businesses are going to be able to utilize this Hyper-V and virtualization technology.
And a small business, you know, isn't going to have the same sort of demands on it that you're talking about for your hosting applications. But there'd be other uses for virtualization in a small business. The one that springs to my mind would be security, where you might have two different server applications, but they need to be separated for the sake of security. You don't want them running on your domain controller necessarily. Is that the sort of thing they'd be used for?
Or even compatibility. There's a case vertical application for a small business, you know, that's specific to their industry, where the company that owns that application insists that they run it on a dedicated machine, even if they've only got five people in the office, in which case it would probably be overkill to run a whole dedicated machine purely for that application. The other instance where its usefulness is going to come up, of course, is with Exchange Server 2007. It actually has a requirement for multiple machines if you want to run it with the proper edge protection and the mailbox servers and the client access servers.
Ah, right, okay.
For a small business running multiple machines.
So you can run the edge machine as a virtual machine.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
That's very cute, isn't it?
Unless, of course, you do it our way, which means that you'd subscribe to our hosted Exchange service and... away with that particular product.
Well, presumably that's what a small business would grow to, a service like that. Let's put it that way around.
Yes. I mean, they start with their own internal mail server, but after a while, the mail servers tend to become a utility service like their telephone, electricity. They just want it to work.
Absolutely.
Yes, and don't we all know it when the electricity doesn't work? Alex and Anthony from your ASP in good old downtown Perth in Western Australia, thank you very much for your time this evening, gentlemen. I think we've learned a lot.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, yes, you've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, and that was Anthony and Alex from your ASP.
Anthony Spiteri and Alexander Lifters, the senior engineer and CIO of your ASP,
now
respectively.
That's a big challenge for the Electoral Commission, I would have thought.
That's a big ask. the pressure of having the additional thing on the day, the wedding on the day, that would be so scary.
There's two things I know from a broadcasting point of view that you don't tend to mix, and one is mission critical and new technology at the same time.
That's right,
a formula for an exciting night.
Well, it sounds like it stood up to the test, which is impressive.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Anthony, for your time this evening. We'll take a break and we'll be back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Do no evil. Google sued for $1 billion.
Is it a job for government, though? Or is it a job for ISPs to provide interlinks?
Hey, yeah. Nerd alert. What?
The thing is, people put it on vibrate or silent, and you can't tell.
Which?
What do you mean, which is which?
You can't vote with your feet because there are no other options.
Oh, did I say that?
Yeah, you might have.
12 megabits, though.
Entertaining.
What's the problem, Dr. Ron?
Informative.
Has it got a network port on the back?
Independent.
Do they do that in some
other
countries?
Absolutely they do.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
No.
She tells me.
Keeps your knees warm, doesn't it?
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back. Andrew McComb here. And Dr. Graham. Well, Graham Callaghan, actually. The doctor is not in this evening. He's out, I don't know, doing whatever he does.
Yeah.
He decides just not to come in from some time. He did the news for us this week, which was very kind of him.
Yeah, well, anyway. Least he could do if he wasn't going to show
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. So you're a bit more wise about Hyper-V now?
Definitely, yeah.
Do you want to hyperventilate? Or,
I'm looking forward to trying it out on the new Microsoft servers. Yeah,
I'm going to play with it. I've got the software there. I was just going to build a machine up and put it through its hoops and see what happens. Anyway, some telecommunications news, which we'll touch on briefly this evening too. Virgin plucks their broadband at home off retail shelves. Now, this was always going to be a bit controversial because... Optus have had issues because Virgin buy some of their bandwidth off Optus.
Oh, okay.
And Optus's mobile broadband has been a little bit ho-hum of recent times. They're being investigated by
ACCC's and like to see if they can actually...
The suggestion's been that they sold too much and, yeah, their network wasn't big enough to cope.
Bit too congested.
Yeah.
Virgin Mobile has confirmed it has stopped selling its broadband at home service via general retail stores. In a bid to improve flagging levels of service, Virgin issued a statement saying it will only sell the product via direct channels, its own stores and its website as of November the 1st. So maybe that's just a way of keeping the volume down sneakily without sort of owning up to the fact that we don't have that much capacity or whatever. The broadband at home service was previously available off the shelf places like Dickies. That's Dick Smith Electronics. Interesting, don't you think? That because it's really, the network, mobile networks, I think you've always alluded to this before, saying we don't need more radio space, we need more ADSL speeds.
Right. There's a limited amount of bandwidth, don't waste it on things that should be done over cables,
Too right. Mobile has its place.
Definitely.
Very hard to get on these days.
But not as the primary delivery method.
No, very true. It's only when you want to sit at somewhere other than your office or your home and you need broadband.
That's right.
Optus. Is another company, well, the guys were talking about this earlier on the chat, are going to put the filters to the test of the federal government too. Just found a little bit of research on that before.
Yes.
The iiNet chief regulator, Stephen Dolby, is the man who's going to give it a go for iiNet. So I'll be doing what you said, Graham, and ringing them up, having a chat about the filter.
Yeah, I'll ring my guys as well, and I think Warlock said he was too.
Optus is going to do the same thing there as well, so who knows. Optus would probably do it anyway. Call me cynical, but I just believe that their network is, they probably want to slow it down a bit so it speeds up for everybody else, if you know what I mean. Good luck if you're on Vodafone or a shared service on Optus, but anyway. That's another story, and they're my opinions. Thank you very much. Don't ring me. Someone did the other day. They rang me and had a go at me about my opinions. I said, well, you come on and have a go. Yeah, a certain manufacturer of plasma screens.
Oh, right.
Haven't I told you about that? Well, I'll talk to you about that off air.
I think you did, actually. Yes.
Yeah, good. Optus Mobile keeps growing. Australia's second biggest telecommunications group grew their net profit by 1.8% in the second quarter of this financial year, which is not bad considering everyone else went south. Optus, which is owned by Singapore Telecommunications, said that the profit rose to 125 mil in the 3 months ending September. Hopefully they've got enough money now to invest in the national broadband network should Terrier actually do something.
I think it sounds like they need to invest in their own network first.
Good point. 125 mil. That'd be good. You could probably put up a few base stations for that, don't you think?
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe get a bit extra fibre between.
Fibre between the base stations.
There's a thought.
A bit of extra backhaul. Yeah, might speed things up. Go Optus.
And not to mention, Vodafone's also growing their customer base as well. I'd have thought we were saturated with mobile phones in this country, but obviously not.
No, everybody's got to own three of them by the end of next year. That's their aim.
I've got my old spare ones, although people trying to nick them recently, but I've still got my old spare ones, and they come in very handy for, the old SIM if you want to be not on your normal SIM card.
It is great. I mean, how many mobile phone SIMs do you own? How many phone services do you actually have?
Currently?
You've got, at least three? You've got one voice and two data ones?
You're talking about business-wise and a business account?
I'm talking combined business and personal.
Yes, I'd have...
That you personally end up being responsible for.
Okay, one, two, three, four, five. Five SIM cards.
There you go. That's a lot. So, yeah, if everybody in Australia had five mobile phone services, then, it'll allow these companies to grow.
Good way of, yes, and especially if you've got a family because the kids need a phone and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
so,
well, there you go.
Anyway, then you get the WAF factor. Oh, I want mine pink, please.
Don't care if it's got any features or whether it's got Bluetooth or not, it's got to be pink.
She knows what an iPod is now.
Oh, good.
Now she's told me the colour she wants too.
Ah, which colour iPod does she want?
Oh, I was either green or purple.
Fair enough.
Anyway, we won't say she could be listening. I doubt it. You never know. What were you talking about, Vodafone? The mobile phone company said its revenue grew 7.4, which is considerably more than what Optus has did.
One was profit and the other's revenue. So.
Okay, well, they had 1.8% second quarter of the financial year. That was Optus. And Vodafone grew 84,000 customers. So we'd have to convert that back to revenue. Yes, you're right. The mobile phone company said, revenue grew by 7.4%. So there you go. That's in the dollars, but I don't know what that equates to in real folding stuff. But 84,000 customers, that's not a bad increase.
I wonder where they've come from.
Maybe out of secondary school, they've been let loose on society.
Well, that's a good point. Are they new subscribers that are coming onto the networks, or have they come from disillusioned users of other networks?
Yes. Anyway, Warlock saying he sold his Motorola on eBay and gave away his Sony Ericsson K800i. I'd give away one of those too. That's pretty good.
Hello to all of our listeners on the chat tonight. Bob from Perth there. Kyphoni's there. Red Baron, you're new. I don't know where he's come from. Maybe somewhere in England. Although Darren's there. Darren from the UK. He's there. Hello to everybody. Come and say good day to us on the Tech Talk Radio
chat
forum. If you're listening to us on the pod, it's a bit tricky because we're not there now. But if you're listening to us live on the streams or around Australia on radio stations.
Yeah, on some radio stations, we might not be there now either.
No, that's
depending
true.
Depending on which station you're listening to.
Yes. It could be Saturday night. We could be out.
If it's Monday night on the east coast of Australia and it's between 8 and 10 Melbourne time, then...
Intel snuck out a new processor during the course.
Did they?
It's been touted for a while, but they finally got out. The Core i7 devices are coming out onto the market now. Because we've got over Pentiums and Pentium 3s and Pentium...
Yeah, and we had the Core Bobs. 2 Duos, and yep. we had dual cores, and we had quad cores.
We've now got the Core i7.
Does that mean it's got 7 cores?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it doesn't. But it's they could have called a bill for everyone's, yes. Anyway, Intel will launch the Core i7 on November the 17th, which was today. If you're listening to us live, if it's not today, it was the other day.
It might have been a few days ago. It's past tense.
So it will be interesting to see what happens now. That means new architecture, new chipsets, new computers, and, of course, the inevitable marketing hype that comes along with a Intel processor chip, and then AMD will come out with something that will do something similar. That's how it works, isn't it, in the marketing side of things of processors?
Yeah, pretty much. One chases the other. It's like a dog chasing its tail. It just keeps going round and round and round and getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Can I ask you a personal question before we go to the break? Are you an AMD man or are you an Intel man?
I'm an Intel man, okay. I'm afraid.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Okay, to the break. We'll come back with more after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Yes, we're back. The i7, do you know it's been benchmarked and tested and all that sort of stuff? This is what we were talking about before the break.
They usually are. This is a new Intel CPU chip.
Yeah, extensively benchmarked, and it's the Nelum Core i7 is what it's called. Sub-$300 range, complimentary X58 chipset that needs to be used in motherboards as well. So there you go, all the new technology coming out. There's some bizarre things coming out too at the moment, which there's some stuff we'll talk about in the Odd Spot and Gadget coming up later on and all that sort of stuff.
I've just been reading about this chip. It has 3-channel memory, so instead of having to have 2 memory modules side by side, you've got to have 3 now. And yeah, DDR.
How does that work? 3 memory model?
Something like that, looks like it.
Oh, very good. All right, some other new gadgets that are out this week. A new Facebook phone launched by 3.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, 3 set to launch. Don't talk to me about the
Facebook
war either, by the way.
Facebook phone.
Yeah, Facebook phone. Dr. Ron, I'd love one of these if only he was here. Called the INQ, this phone will give users instant access to Facebook. It comes with a live address book that will display your friend's Facebook status and picture profile picture. The handset also features intelligent applications like email, Skype, Windows Live Messaging, RSS feed, if you're that way inclined, as well as other customizable network and sharing tools. What a great gadget. That'll be out shortly. It'll be on 3.
Specifically for the Facebook addict.
Absolutely. You're not a Facebook
person.
That's
scary. I'm not a Facebook fan at all. I've got a Facebook page, but I deliberately allow it to wither and die.
Yeah, I'm not a Facebook person either. Anyway, more about that later. Battery-powered credit card supercard fights fraud. Did you know?
No.
You've got to carry a little battery around for your credit card.
Oh, no. Oh, that's...
A small Australian tech firm believes it can stop up to $1 billion a year in credit card fraud with its new battery-powered supercard.
Yeah, because the battery is flat, so you can't use your card. Yeah, that'll
do. Help. Next story. Moving right along. The card includes an alphanumeric display, built-in microprocessor.
Crikey.
No wonder it needs a battery. Yeah, anyway, the built-in microprocessor, a keypad, 3 years of battery power, all built in. Yeah, good.
When a user enters a PIN into the card, the display shows a one-time number with an authentication on another line to do the transaction. So I don't know how. But anyway, each card costs about 5 times more than the regular credit card to produce and will be sold to bank customers during overseas travel, overseas trials between $18 and $30 US. The technology was developed over 2.5 years by a small firm called EMUE Technologies based in Adelaide and Melbourne.
Okay.
That's good. Oh, look, all
sounds
for,
interesting. Yeah.
All for the difference. So you must, obviously, you're powered and you obviously put in your PIN number or you sign and it generates some form of authentication
device.
Yeah,
so you can't use it unless you actually key your PIN into the card itself.
Yeah.
So if you steal the card, you obviously won't know the PIN, so you can't use it.
Well, that's right. In other interesting news, the ACCC has rejected Telstra's Optus's HFC exemption. You know the big black cables that hang in the skies here in the metropolitan areas around town?
Yeah.
Most capital cities. The ACCC issued a final decision rejecting Telstra's request to be released from its obligations to provide regulated services to Optus's HFC network. You know,
okay.
Optus subscriber, eh?
No.
Okay. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission issued the decision to reject Telstra's request and to be exempt from providing extra fixed line services to Optus. So that must be what they'd be doing up through there.
Yeah.
Yes. So there you go. Telstra have, another separation.
So Telstra being forced to allow Optus onto their network.
Absolutely.
Is the gist of it? Yeah.
I guess so.
Where they're a monopoly.
Now, another interesting bit of news that came out this week. Texting keeps kids slim. Do you believe this?
No.
No, neither did I, but I thought I'd have to talk about it anyway. A new study from the... We're into studies on this show,
highly,
as you know.
Highly developed thumb muscles.
Well, with preemptive, or what do you call predictive text, there's a very interesting sketch that floats around on YouTube about predictive text. Have you seen it?
No.
Just go and have a search on YouTube and have a look for predictive text. It's quite humorous, actually, if you've got the moment. I should try and find the URL. I'll put it up on our website and link to it or something like that. A new study from the University of North Carolina shows that if kids use SMS when they are young, they are less likely to become overweight adults. The idea is that if you can get your kids to have better habits when they're younger, then they are less likely to eclipse the sun as they get older. I still can't see the link here between texting and kids and fitness and eclipsing suns. Jennifer Shapiro, who is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the UNC School of Medicine and principal investigator of the new study, said that the self-monitoring of calorie intake and expenditure of body weight is extremely important for the long-term success of a weight loss control program. Her study, which was published in November and December of 2008, of the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, said that kids are useless at self-monitoring. Oh, now I start to see the link. You can text each other and say, you're getting a bit tubby.
Okay.
However, if they reported their progress via SMSs and received feedback messages in return, they're much more likely to stick to the program. You've got to be kidding, haven't you? She said that by using the technology, her team were hoping to make self-monitoring seem more fun to them and less like work. In fact, kids that keep a paper diary are worse than in the group control, apparently, than those who just wanted to stick to diets and texted each other. It's funny, isn't it?
It's a remarkable use of the technology. I wouldn't have thought of that.
For what it was, what SMS was worth, it was just an add-on to a telephone exchange. But now we can use that to keep kids slim. Believe it if you want. So, anyway. Do you remember Senator Coonan, the Honourable? I don't know. She's the Minister for something or other.
She's currently the Manager of Business for the Opposition in the Senate, if I remember correctly.
Something like that.
So she's still the Honourable Senator Helen Coonan.
Well, she had to have her 2 cents worth in on the NBN during the week, the National Broadband Network. She came out and said that the Rudd government was hopelessly compromised on its plan to build the National Broadband Network.
Mm-hmm.
As you do. Telecommunications giant Telstra has told the government it will not be participating in any part of the estimated $15 billion project unless the notion of structural separation is taken off the table. It's on again, off again separation, isn't it? Split up the working part from the retail part and
jig
it all around. So
Which we talked about in New Zealand.
Yeah. Well, we talked about this last week. And, as you say, the New Zealand example is there. Opposition frontbencher Helen Coonan also said that... she described Telstra's decision as a wake-up call. The government doesn't have a plan that will be rolled out anytime soon for a national broadband network. Now, she said that on ABC television, which is, I think, true. Would you agree with that? Where is the plan, Conroy? What are you doing about it? We've been hiding behind this get the tenders in by November and they're going to announce something. Well, we're nearly out of November. Hadn't you noticed?
Yeah. I'm not sure, though. Did you say she was saying that they need to drop plans
she said they
to
didn't
try
have a
and
plan.
Separate the network?
Well, she didn't have a plan for the rollout of the network. It's not going to roll out anytime soon.
No.
I don't agree with her. It's not. And at 12 megabits per second, I think that needs a revamp, don't you?
Well, there's a lot of places that can't even get 12 now, so I think it's a starting point rather than an end result. I think once you get there, then you'll immediately need to look to go to the next level. But if you put some infrastructure in place to get us at least that far, yeah, maybe it's a start.
All right. There's a bit of a wrap. I'm always sceptical about this broadband network. Seeing will be believing. Telstra's
exactly.
Probably got it there already. They just want to turn it on as soon as they get the money. Ting-ka-ching, there it is. Done.
I think the problem is that anything that's there already isn't good enough to do the job for a lot of areas. That's the problem. Because it's using the old telephone lines.
But I think it's the same whether you're in Sydney, Brisbane or Melbourne or in Townsville or in Alice Springs or anywhere.
In Sydney
you're supposed
or Brisbane,
to get the same service.
Yeah, but you don't because in the towns you're much closer to your telephone exchange and you've got much higher quality lines. When you're in the bush, you're a long way from your telephone exchange a lot of the time, and the technologies we use here, like ADSL 2+, just aren't available. They just don't work.
Mm.
And to get that sort of broadband out there, you're going to have to put in some new technology, some fiber or some hybrid coax or something like that.
Okay. All right, and in sad news, before we go to the break, mm-hmm. The passing of the Martian probe, the Phoenix probe, which is on Mars, the winter got to it and
this
killed
is
its
the
batteries.
One that, so it's not going to well.
No more pics from Mars, I'm afraid.
Well, it never was going to have the life. It was the rovers had an extraordinarily extended life and so on. But yes, this one was always going to get got by the cold. It's a bit sad that it's happened.
Yeah, but it's a feat that it got there and landed there in the first place.
Yep, it's impressive. Yeah, only about 50% of these missions to Mars succeed. So it was definitely one of the winners.
Indeed. Time for a break. Back with a gadget, odd spot, and website of the week. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening.
Residual powers. And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
Listening.
In terms of the volume.
Motorists have to give fingerprints. Now, this...
We may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometres
per
second was good.
That you're not expecting, even if they do a thing.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! This thing is amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Son of a... Oh!
There are certain things that you come across in the course of day-to-day browsing of the internet, and this is one of them. There's a new telephone company out there called Sany Ericsson. Did you know?
No.
Spelled S-A-N-Y... And Ericsson, E-R-I-C-S-S-A-N.
Oh, no.
Anyway, they have a phone called an A8000i. it says, move over Xpernia X1. I'm not familiar with that phone, but here's a brand new competitor known as the Sany Ericsson 8000A that plays the role of an undercover X1 to fool unsuspecting victims into parting with their hard-earned cash.
Oh, no.
This Sliders tri-band handset will retail for $192.99. If you purchase it in bulk and if you're able to sell it for $289.99, the features include GSM 900, 1.8 and all the rest of the tri-band stuff, dual GSM SIM cards, a megapixel camera, only 1 megapixel, that's better than that on an iPhone, isn't it? And Bluetooth connectivity with a built-in internet FM radio, but just the name Sany Ericsson did it for me. I just thought, that's...
Yeah, that's... Check the name on your phone if you're going to buy one. I typed it into Google and it said, did you mean Sony Ericsson?
No, I meant Sany, S-A-N-Y Ericsson, 8000 iClone, the Tech Talk Radio, incredibly silly gadget of the week.
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Now, here's an interesting one. Have you ever wondered how secure your password is? Lydia Davis taught me about this. This is very good. One of her little things.
Yeah, this is one of my bugbears with my customers, secure passwords.
If you want to know how long your password, or how sort of short a period of time someone could hack your password, how long it's secure for is probably what I was trying to say. If you go to a website called Hacktosis, should I say? Now, unfortunately, there's no short link to this. I'll put it up on our website later for the website of the week. So you can go click there if you don't quite catch this. But if you go to all the W's, Hacktosis, HACKOSIS.com, just remember that big, then slash projects, slash BFCalc, and then /bfcalc.php, you'll get a calculator. And the calculator, you can put in how many uppercase letters, how many lowercase letters, numbers, special characters, and all that into your password, and it'll tell you how quickly a bot will take to break that password if it really wants to get through it. Quite an interesting little tool, I thought, especially if you want to prove to the fact that someone puts in, you know, Hawthorn Football Club, Richmond Football, RFC, you know, the silly passwords you get, the dog's name, the cat's name, and all that sort of stuff. Because there's a few people that do that sort of stuff.
We should talk about some password guidelines. Why not on the show?
All right, let's do it next week. You in for it? I wonder if anyone else is.
Yeah, I think so,
All right, so there you go. I'll put that up on the website, but that's the Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Showtime. Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
Off you go, Graham. You got 30 seconds.
Okay. As NASA prepares to double the number of astronauts living aboard the International Space Station, nothing may do more for crew bonding than a machine being launched aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour. It's a water recycling device that will process the crew's urine and turn it into water for the crew to drink on board. Bob Bagdigian from NASA, he was the lead system engineer on the thing. They did blind taste tests of the water, and nobody had any strong objections, which makes you wonder what the minor ones were.
I saw the Chaser boys do this.
A faint taste of urine, and it's just as refreshing as any other kind of water. He says he's got some in his fridge, and it tastes fine. This is $250 million worth of recycling gear going up on the space shuttle. Now, the best bit is, though, I was looking for information on this, and on the Sydney Morning Herald site, in an article headed "One Wee Step for Man," I found this paragraph. There's also a rapidly growing population back here on Earth, and we could do with some more loos down here, says the World Toilet Organization, a non-profit group committed to improving toilet and sanitation conditions worldwide. So I never knew they existed.
Absolutely,
but
fantastic.
Yes,
so you learn
they're doing
here.
Well on the space shuttle, and they're going to have two toilets instead of one, and they're going to be able to recycle the water.
Ah, fantastic. Stick with us. You'll hear all the great stuff here on Tech Talk Radio. And speaking of sticking with us, time's up. Catch
that's
us
the end.
Same time, next place, whenever we come back, which will be this time next week. Come visit us on the chat, chat.techtalkradio.com.au. There's lots of people there tonight. Good on you guys. Yep. See you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.